Hi, this is Nick Ulbrich, contributing producer to Synchronize Radio. What you're about to hear was recorded on the 11th of April 2014 on a rainy, autumny night in Melbourne. I was fortunate enough to go to the Astor Theatre and see 2001 A Space Odyssey on the big screen. Prior to the session, Keir DeLay and Gary Lockwood presented a Q&A session, and there's also quite a long introduction to the film from a Melbourne film critic. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you.
It's recording.
So when you watch anything in outer space, this is all handmade models. The star backdrops, these are all hand-painted star backdrops, not computer-generated. There's artists painting stars on black canvas and black cloth. It's quite unique. And also, for most of the film scenes in the film in outer space, of course, there's no sound, because there is no sound in space. In fact, there's no dialogue at all for the first 25 minutes of the film. But it's my great pleasure now to introduce the man who's going to talk a little more about the film and how it fits in with the history of cinema. Before we bring in our two very special guests tonight, the two stars of the film, Mr. Keir DeLay and Gary Lockwood. But please welcome film historian, film reviewer, film critic, film preservationist, a walking encyclopedia on film, a man who was working at the Plaza Cinema in Collins Street when this film opened in 70mm at the Plaza in 1968. The film was often, by the way, including the film you see tonight, billed as being in Cinerama. That was more of a marketing ploy. It was never actually screened in Cinerama, which is the three projector process. But James Sherlock was working at the Plaza back in 1968 when it screened there. So what better than to take us through the story of 2001? Please make welcome to stage with a big round of applause, Mr. James Sherlock.
It was May 3rd, 1968 that it opened at the Plaza Theatre, so in about 3 weeks' time, it's 46 years ago. I wasn't a projectionist, I wasn't in management, I was too young. I was what they call a schoolboy, and they don't exist anymore. I was a trainee, I was a little kid, I was still going to school, and my job was to rewind the spools for the projectionists. And the 70mm spools were so big that I had to get them to help me to put them on the rewinder. But it was a remarkable experience, and it was my first foray into cinema. It was 2001 at the Plaza, and when my duties weren't required down there, I was up at the Regent with Sergio Leone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, another one of the great cinema masterpieces. Now, 2001, A Space Odyssey, I have to admit, the very first time I saw it as a young kid, I absolutely hated it because I couldn't understand it. I thought, what in, because I was 12 years old, I thought, what in God's name is this rubbish? Then a few years later, when I started dating girls, I remember speaking to a girl, and I said, let's go to the movies. And she said, well, I said, what would you like to see? And she said, there was a revival of 2001. And I thought, oh, God. But you're young, and you want to impress your girlfriend, and you know, the whole thing. So you have to suffer for your art. So I went back and saw 2001. I liked it even more. Something stirred very deeply inside me. That had never happened before in a live cinema. A couple of years later, the same thing happened again. I had a lot of girls. And I suddenly realised, and I'm paraphrasing Woody Allen here, because I heard him say nearly exactly the same thing, that he suddenly realised that the filmmaker and the writer, Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick, were ahead of the audience, and they still are to this day. We're talking about a film in which, of course, opens with one of the most famous and one of the most unforgettable sequences in motion picture history and concludes. But the opening sequence, the alignment of the stars. Now, the alignment of everything that took place to create this movie was perfect at the time. We have the right writer in Arthur C. Clarke, the right director in Stanley Kubrick. What a magnificent vision. Special effects, Douglas Trumbull. The cast, Keir DeLay and Gary Lockwood, everything fell into place, and that doesn't happen all the time. Cinema is a very, very difficult, very fickle industry. Only, there's a lot of movies out there, hundreds of them, that have reached and pushed the boundaries of the art form and cinema. Very few have broken it and smashed it. As a matter of fact, there's only three in the talking language art of cinema. In other words, the silent era is another one altogether. The first one was Citizen Kane. There's a film that not only reached the boundary, it smashed it. Hollywood has always stuck to a rule book, and it still does to this day. That's why we don't ever see anything like this, and never will ever again. It sticks to a rule book and a structure of filmmaking. Sounds cold, but it's the business. That's what exactly it's all about. Citizen Kane went beyond that. It smashed the rules. It threw all the rules out the window and has become, arguably, equally, the most influential film in motion picture history, along with 2001. Just when we experienced and begun to realise that Citizen Kane had created that, it had inspired a monstrous generation of filmmakers, incredible generation of filmmakers. William Friedkin, George Lucas, there's so many, Steven Spielberg, myself to work in the industry. I think it is the great masterpiece along with 2001. Just when we thought we'd seen it all, there was many other great films would follow, but none would smash that barrier. Then, of course, in 1968, 2001 arrived on our screens. These films, thank God, are unremakable. We're not going to see a reboot, rehash, re-this, re-that, sequel, prequel, where we did see a sequel. Nothing compares to the original. They are unremakable. William Friedkin told me, he calls it the movie God. Everything came together at exactly the right right time. And 2001 is one of those films. The Burkill, by the way, is what we're screening here next week, which is Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in the West. And I actually heard director John Borman say that if you married 2001, A Space Odyssey, with Once Upon a Time in the West, you have the culture of the human race right there in two films, just two movies. They are the masterpieces of cinema. And I have to agree with you exactly that. So if you haven't seen Once Upon a Time in the West, you've got to come here and experience it, because that's exactly what it is. But 2001, A Space Odyssey, again, is one of the great, great, great experiences. Everything came together at exactly the right time. And it has gone on not only to entertain, to stimulate, to anger, to confuse, but also to grow with audiences throughout the generations. This film is more relevant today than it was when it came out in 1968. What an extraordinary vision that Stanley Kubrick has created, and bless him for filming this movie, for telling this story in the great 70mm process. It would not quite, I think, have the same effect that it did under Wood, if it was shot at 35mm. But Kubrick knew something was happening. There was a change happening, and 2001 was it. We've never experienced a movie like it before. We've never experienced a movie like it since. And two of the elements from that film that make this movie so perfect and make it such an extraordinary cinematic masterpiece and experience, and one of the two greatest films ever made. Now, let's not forget, George Lucas said if there was no 2001 Space Odyssey, there would be no Star Wars. And that's just one influence we're talking about. There are thousands of them out there. But the two people I'm about to introduce are two of those elements that make this movie the masterpiece that it really is. Such an important part in our culture. It just, as I said, pushes the boundaries of not only space and time, but our own culture as the cultures move along through the generations. No other movie has ever done that. And two people responsible for that in this film you're going to see. For those who haven't seen 2001, you're in for a major experience. And for those who have, you're in for another major experience. Because it doesn't matter how many times you've seen this movie, you will learn something new. So I will start travelling on here and carrying on. I could be up here with the mic. Let's get those two special elements up here. They are absolutely wonderful people. I've had the pleasure of their company before. I couldn't wish to be in a better place at a better time anywhere in the world right now. And I couldn't wish to say more proudly, please give a great, warm Melbourne welcome to the stars of 2001, Keir Delay and Gary Loughlin.
Iconic film. Thank you, Stanley. It, The magic of this film has to do with the fact that it transcends eras. It transcends periods of time. It was obviously appreciated in that very special time of the 60s, and here we are in 2014, and look at all these people here who have come to see this film.
And we're also in Melbourne.
When?
We're in Melbourne.
We're in Melbourne. I was in Melbourne. This is my third time to be here for the screening in 2001. I was in Melbourne for the Melbourne premiere in 1968. So this is my third time in Melbourne. But this is the most exciting because as the film has aged so well. It was not an iconic film in 1968, or nor was it probably even 10 years after 1968. It's been a very gradual journey for this film to have become the kind of iconic film that it has.
I do remember someone saying back in 1968 when the film started, it did, as you said, it did not do very well right at the very beginning. However, they were about to pull it and replace it with a film called Ice Station Zebra with Roy Hudson, because it was not doing great, it was not doing great box office. And this had stunned studio executives. They didn't know what to make of it because they were of the old school back then. They went back to the Simon days. And here was this monstrous monolith that they just didn't know how to understand. But a theatre owner, I think it was in New York City, rang MGM. And I'm about to pull it off that week. And he said, can you please keep the film going for at least another 2 weeks? And I asked why. And he said, something's happening. There was two people turned up this morning, and I sat down the front. There was 8 people at the afternoon session. There was 14 people at specific spots, or different people at specific spots. He could see that something was going on, and that it was about to happen. Did you recognize that feeling when you first saw the movie that it would be a word of mouth movie?
May I take this? I was sort of taken to task by the press because I'm a cowboy, I grew up in the country, and I would drive into Los Angeles to see movies. And I saw a Kubrick film when I was 16 years old. I came home and I had a couple of buddies who were smart and were talking to about films. And I said, I saw an unbelievable movie. And it was the only time I ever stopped and looked at the poster in the movie house. It was a little tiny movie. It was called The Killing, and Stanley Kubrick had made it. So 3 years later, I'm playing football at UCLA, and let me tell you something. Football at UCLA in September with the devil winds coming off the desert and it's 110 degrees is not what you want to do. And I was a bit of a hustler as a kid. I lived on the beach in Malibu and I drove a Porsche and I was not a very normal student. And I, you got who I am. And I got up that morning and I got the LA Times and I read and it said that Stanley Kubrick's new movie, Paths of Glory, is opening in Los Angeles. In Hollywood, right across from the Grammys Chinese, this kind of really famous movie house in L.A., in downtown Hollywood. So I had to go to training table. They really, UCLA is one of the top football teams in America, and you have to go and eat certain food and work out twice that day, and it's 108 degrees. It's just terrible. And I said, that does it. I'm not going today. So I got my tray of food and I turned around and here are these 9 football coaches, which means there were 18 eyes responding. And I turned with my tray of food and I said, Coach, I can't come to practice today. And they were all Southerners. And you know what that means, but it means, you can't what? they were all like Strother Martin and Butch Cassidy. Yeah, thank you. And so, I said, they said, why can't you come to practice? And I said, and I didn't know what I was going to say. And then it just came to me. I'm a natural born liar. And I said, well, Coach, I've got a ticket this summer on the way back from San Francisco. And one of them said, in that funny little car he used where nobody knows where to put the gas. I said, yes, I did. I have to be in court. Now, if they had any wits about them, they'd have known that was a lie. And I drove into Hollywood, and I saw the thing four times. And then I went back and had dinner. So anyway, when I got the call from Kubrick, he'll tell you what he did. I just turned to my agent, and I said, what's it going to cost me to be in that movie? The point that I want to make is that I knew we were going to be here. And Kier will verify. And the press really badgered me for saying that. And slowly, over a period of time, I got even more. And when we were honored by the Academy, I had a moment to say my piece. You know what I mean?
I'd like to, before I go any further, I intended to say this before we start. I'd like to dedicate this screening tonight. It's a very special event. It's a very special screening to Kieran Kane.
It's thrilling to be here.
How did you get your apartment? How did you get your apartment?
I was making a film in London with Laurence Olivier and Carolyn Lee called Bunny Lake is Missing. Directed by one of the great bullies in our business, Otto Preminger. He made some nice films, but he was not a pleasant man to work at all. So I would go to work every day with a black cloud over my head. Working with Olivier was wonderful, but it didn't quite make up for having to work for this horror. Anyway, one day I came home and my wife said, after shooting, and she said, call your agent. So I called my agent. My agent said, are you sitting down? And I said, no, why? He said, you better sit down. I said, why? You've just been offered the lead in Stanley Kubrick's next film. Out of the blue, I had no idea I was being considered. I had never met Sandy. I didn't audition for it. Now, it turned out later, I found out that he had screened several of my films, including outtakes from Bunny Lake is Missing. He screened a film that I had received a Golden Globe for called David and Lisa, and then he screened film I did with Jack Warden called The Thin Red Line. And based on that, he cast me, but I had no idea I was being considered. And as Gary has mentioned, my first experience, I was in drama school, and my first experience of seeing a product of Stanley Kubrick was Paths of Glory, which happens to be my favorite Kubrick film. And if anybody here hasn't seen Paths of Glory, see it. It's brilliant. One of the great anti-war films, probably since All Quiet in the Western Front, on the Western Front.
What about you, Gary? How did you secure the role in this film?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that exactly.
How did you get the role?
Oh, I never auditioned. I mean, it didn't. When you work for somebody as smart as Stanley Kubrick, I mean, he makes all these decisions, you know, way before you start shooting. And one day, I don't know, we were setting, you know, it was 2001, we didn't get very many shots per day, sometimes none. And once I had a quiet time with him, and I was sitting there, and I said, hey, how'd I get this job? And he said, well, I looked at about 50 hours of film on you, and it really fit, right? I mean, Stanley Kubrick, I thought, well, maybe he selected me because I was a cowboy stuntman and I could do the wire work, you know, for the space or something. But, you know, I got the job. And when we premiered in Washington, no one liked it very much. We went to New York. It was a little better that night. And third night, we went to L.A. And Kira and I are sitting with our wives at that time, standing outside at the intermission. And Gene Hackman and Warren Beatty had just made Bonnie and Clyde. And Warren Beatty came up and had campaigned to be in the movie. I don't know if you did that. I told you that one day. Warren Beatty campaigned to play Dave Holman. And Warren stuck his head. I had made a movie, Splinter in the Grass, with Warren a few years before. And he stuck his head and he looked right at me. And he's a very bright guy. And he goes, you're lucky. See, that. In acting circles, Kubrick is the magic term. And we had a few film students through tonight, and would say things about Kubrick, and I'd say, are you in film school? Maybe yes.
But a lot of people out of that L.A. screening, the original, first the premiere in L.A., walked out, including Rock Hudson, walked out and said, what is this bunch of bull about? And just walked out. But a lot of people, and also it was, you know, I noticed tonight a lot of you people that came and asked for our autographs were a lot of young people who hadn't even been born when this film came up, which is great. Compliment to this film. Well, this is my point. And you know, that happened in 1968. A few months later, as the film began to do a little better, they noticed, and this was the year when people were smoking funny cigarettes, MGM took note of this, and they changed the advertising slogan on the posters. The new posters read, 2001 A Space Odyssey, the ultimate trip.
I had a guy come up to me one day, and he went, hey, man. Like, I live in Malibu, and these are stony surfers, you know what I'm saying? I'm an ex-surfer, so. But they would go like this, hey, man, instead of 2001, it's really far out. And I would say, well, thank you. They would say, so, were you at Stanley Kubrick on Acid Men? And I said, before and after, but not during.
You know that there was an incident that happened. One of the longest initial runs of the film was in San Francisco, again, in that era, and you know what San Francisco was famous for. And apparently, a matinee of the film, toward the end, when my character is going through time and space before he ends up in that Louis the 16th room, suddenly, from the back of the house, this young man came screaming down the aisle, running full thrust, screaming, it's God, it's God, and listen, and jumped up on the stage and ran right through the screen.
That was one of those nights where the theater owner only made money on popcorn. Okay, now, Key, you tell me, you were seeing stories, you watched 2001, not that long ago, and you suddenly realized, or there was a new revelation, about a famous scene, of course, the scene with the ape.
Oh, you mean that when the ape throws the bone?
Yeah.
The John Man sequence when the lead ape in triumph after beating the opposing, someone from the opposing team, the ape team, he throws the bone, which is symbolically the very first weapon, into the air, and it slow motion morphs into a space vehicle. Well, I've only recently discovered that space vehicle wasn't just a space vehicle, it was a nuclear weapon. Because in the book 2001, Arthur C. Clarke envisioned that in the year 2001, the Soviet Union and the United States would be at loggerheads, and each side would have nuclear weapons in permanent orbit around the Earth, and any one of which could be rain death upon the Earth at the touch of a button. So if you think about it, cinematically, it is, in my opinion, the greatest jump cut in the history of the cinema, where the first weapon morphs into the most recent weapon.
And that's more relevant today.
One other thing I might... one of the people came up and asked me to sign my autograph, and I said I would mention it in the Q&A, because he asked me and I didn't want to hold up the line. I'm sure most of you may know that there was no computer-generated special effects in the film at all. Everything you see in this film was done physically, one way or the other, maybe chemically at times, but no computer stuff. And he asked, this gentleman asked me how they got the shot when Hal won't let me in and I have to go through the emergency hatch and blow myself in into a vacuum temporarily and then reach for a lever and so on. How that was done, because when you watch the film, I seem to be shooting laterally toward you, therefore weightless. How that was shot was, it was three stories high, and the set the little opening of the pot was up there, and the camera is down here. And they had measured how what the length was, and a circus roustabout was on a platform outside the set, but at the same height, three stories high. And he had measured, and I had one piano wire attached to my spacesuit, which went up and around out of sight and was woven into a rope. And what this roustabout had done had measured how long the rope had to be before a huge knot that he tied would reach his gloved hands. And he did that several times so that he could get several shots. So what happened was I dove head first at freefall, because they couldn't use a stuntman, because if you remember my character in his rush to save his buddy has left his helmet behind. And I'm falling freefall to a number of inches from the lens. At that point, the roustabout jumped off the platform and I went hurtling back up to the ceiling. And as soon as the knot reached his hands, he let go again. And I went hurtling back to the lens. So it was a block and tackle effect. Fortunately, we got that in one take.
You know, you're very fortunate, because had you not, you'd have 7 millimeter eyes. Is it true that when you were eating in the spice wheel upside down, you were actually strapped into your chest? Is that true?
Well,
what they did is I had a harness, and this is funny. They put the harness on me, and you know, I was a cowboy stuntman. I've done all kinds of weird things, so I wasn't uptight. I just said, okay, put it on. So I put this on, and then I got a robe. I run around the ship and exercise and shadow boxed, and now I have this robe on. And so they wheel me, and the centrifuge is 65 feet high, two halves like this. So they wheel me up to the top, and you know, the idea is I'm supposed to be cool, you know. So I'm up there, and Stanley says, all right, Stanley, when he said action, he wasn't like one of these bullying young film school guys. He would just go, all right, action. And he said, so Lockwood, start to eat on action. Okay, man. Action. So I'm upside down, really trying to be cool. And I take this fork and I stick it in, and there's yellow, red, and blue gobbledygook, whatever the hell it is. And I go, shh. As I pull it to my mouth, it goes like this. The biggest sci-fi Rorschach test in the history of man. The bottom of the centrifuge is destroyed. So that was the end of that day's work. Eventually, they got something to stick, and as he knows, I hate oatmeal. I like bacon and eggs. I hate oatmeal. I hate it. And I absolutely hate it. I've always hated it. From the day I met, here's English oatmeal. So I still hate it. Well, they had to make my food out of oatmeal. So when you watch the movie, you see me going, that's probably the best acting I've done in my career.
Just to finish that scene up, so another special effect done without a computer. So there's Gary upside down, all in one shot, and then I emerge through the hub and come down the ladder. He's still up there, and you can see him way up there. I come up here, get some food, and then I walk up to him, seemingly upside down, all in one shot to him, and then slide into my seat, and they cut to another angle. Well, all I did was they revolved him down to me, and I just stood walking in place like that. So when you see it, that's how it was done.
Now the legendary Kubrick. Now you work with two legendary people. I don't want to separate Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick. What are your feelings about those two men?
About Arthur?
They're Arthur and Stanley.
All right.
How was your working?
You know, there's Batman and Robin, the dynamic duo. I think that I can tell you something. Arthur C. Clarke was, you know, maybe what, the best top science fiction writer, I guess.
And Stanley was certainly the best director in the world. And when we were flying to New York on the third day, Kieran Ray Lefter was sitting just in back of Arthur and I, and we're in a 707, we're heading to LA, and Arthur and I are sitting there talking. And Arthur turns to me and he says, "You know, I'm amazed at Stanley." Because, and Arthur was not a film guy, you have to understand, he's a typewriter guy. And he said, "I was amazed," because I think he hadn't seen the film until New York the night before. And he said, I must tell you, I had a lot of confidence in Stanley, but I marveled at the film. He said, "I was totally and completely amazed. I was almost always afraid to make a movie, you know, about my work and everything." And I turned to Arthur and I said, "Arthur, you're a very smart man, but believe me, that's the only guy in the world could have made that movie." And he said, "Really?" And I said, "Yeah. He's the only guy in the entire world smart enough to make that movie." And that's what I want to say about Stanley.
The other thing I'd like to add in terms of your question was, a lot of people ask or say that they've heard that he was difficult to work with. Well, let me tell you, anything but. This man never raised his voice. He was very calm. He didn't over-direct because, you know, one of the talents necessary for a great director is casting. If you cast well, really well, you don't have to do a lot of direction because the person already has all the elements you've been looking for in the first place. And we had bios. We were supposed to have double doctorates and so on. But Stanley was a lovely guy. And there's also the rumor that he had innumerable takes. Well, I think maybe that increased as his work continued in the years beyond when we worked with him. But generally, when there was another take, it was because for technical reasons. This was a very technical
thing. He also allowed you to experiment a bit.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody reminded me of something. He was very open. You could suggest anything, and he'd think about it and sometimes use it. It was my idea, and he used it. In the end of the film, when I'm in that strange room, each younger version of me sees something or hears something and looks, and then Stanley cuts to what he looks at, what my younger version looks at, and it's an older version. The older version looks back. There's no explanation, but the first version is just not there. And I suggested that to Stanley. Instead of having an image disappearing in a puff of smoke, I said, "Why don't you just not have it there at all?" So, yes, he was very open to his actors. That
were you? You must have known what was coming. But were you prepared for what you saw on the film screen?
You mean, have we ever seen? I saw a lot of the Russians, yeah. And there are a lot of really great shots that you will never see, because he had made some decision not to put them in. But you have to remember, I mean, we really didn't go to Jupiter. It's a movie all the way. It's just what it was. For example, John Lennon bought 2 tickets every day for 1 year and gave them away free in Leicester Square. When we sign autographs, I was signing autographs one day in San Diego Comic-Con. It's a huge show, 130,000 people. And 2 young guys came up, like on a Friday, and they said, "How many of these we call our flagship? Some of you bought them today." One with a computer is reading our lips. And they said, "How many of these could I get for $500? So I said, "Are you guys dealers? You know, you want some kind of deal?" And they said, "Well, I don't know." So I gave them some extra ones. And then they came back the next day and bought another 500. And then on Sunday, only one came back and he bought $600 worth. And the upshot of the story is about every 2 or 3 years I go to San Diego. So some years have gone by and I go back, and one of them came back. And I said, "Well,
You're the guy. He said, yeah, I'm the guy. He said, I said, what's your name? He said, well, he's not with me right now. He couldn't come today, but I said, tell me something. Why did you do that? Why? You didn't ask for any deal or just, he said, it was the greatest move we ever made. And I said, what did you do? He said, we were young guys. We were out of school. We were into computer programming. And we had designed software. And so for Christmas, we sent your, what we call our flagship, we sent your 11 by 14 out as Christmas cards. And he said, and later on, when we were making calls on these people as we were in business with them, we would see that thing on the wall. So some of you bought, we sold 30 of those tonight. And I just want you to know that that image is on the walls of some of the most brilliant people in high tech. I mean, on Bezos, I mean, it's on a lot of famous people.
But to answer your question, but my reaction when I first saw the film was just beyond anything I could describe. No matter, even though shot for shot, I sort of, oh yeah, I remember I did that. Yeah. But it was 2 years after I had finished the film, and it just, I was overcome.
I've held back on the questions for a special reason, because I know the audience wanted to ask you questions. I'm going to have a pass over the microphone to Jeremy. Key of Gary, you've both been a tremendous inspiration. Numerous talks, it's been an absolute pleasure. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Please welcome Jeremy back. And you can ask the boys some questions yourself.
Thank you, Sherlock.
So, folks, we've only got a short amount of time. I won't go over the film, but if you've got a question, you're upstairs, make your way to the microphone, which is to your right up here. If you're downstairs, make your way to the microphone over here. We'll take a few questions from the floor. Make sure you speak squarely with the microphone so we can all hear. Really project and speak quiet the microphone. There's one up here and there's one down here. We got someone ready upstairs to go ready. Seth, we'll just say your name and who you, and then ask your question.
Hi, my name is Nick. I'm currently studying a thesis on dispersive theories, and I would love your opinion on the theories concerning this film being in some way connected to the Apollo missions. Specifically, if you could comment on Kubrick's flipping of certain frames throughout the film.
You didn't get that. So basically you're asking about, and I didn't quite get, just repeat the last part of the question. Speak a bit louder for us.
Sorry, the clipping of certain frames.
The clipping of certain frames.
Yeah, like reversing them in the sequence.
Do you know anything about that, about Kubrick clipping certain frames in the film?
You're talking about when they took 16 minutes out, is that your question?
The footage that was deleted
from the premiere. When he took out in the editing?
Yeah.
Do you know what was cut? The 19 minutes that was cut?
I know about that. They took out 16 minutes. And somebody mentioned recently that they were thinking of re-releasing it with the 16 minutes back in. Forget about it. I mean, it doesn't enhance the movie at all. Well, I think the desire was from the exhibitors because they wanted to get the people back to the popcorn.
It's a long movie.
It's a long film, but I think they wanted to shorten it. And what was edited out of the film was really not very important. You remember how much extra vehicular activity there is, where very slowly one or two of us went outside the ship to fix something. All they did was, there were longer sequences,
right?
And they cut a lot of that out.
I think also you might have been alluding to, I think you've had a question there, to the NASA moon landing. There were some rumours, I think is what you're saying, that footage from 2001, those people who believe we never went to the moon, used footage from, is that what you were saying? Footage from 2001 was used by NASA to fake the moon landing.
No, I'm getting asked that every once in a while. I don't even know how to answer. Here and I do autograph shows. We're two of the only actors who ever really do them with the astronauts. And we know them. I mean, they're people we know on a first-name basis. And believe me, I mean, those guys went to the moon. They flew the shuttle. Some died. And they're all upset. Our program is defunct now, more or less.
Yeah. Was there a question from down the bottom here? You say your name first and speak nice and loud for us.
Yeah, my name is Mark. A few years ago, I'm not sure if you guys are aware of this, but I practically begged Mr.
George Forrest in late 2010 in the year we made contact in the year 2010, because I said to him, I don't want to see it in the year 2011 because then it will be in the past. You know, I wanted to see it while it was still. My question is for Mr. Delay. How do you feel when you were approached for, I mean, because obviously 2001 is not the type of film you were thinking of making a sequel to. How did you feel when you were approached for 2010? Did you think it was going to work? And what do you think of the final result of 2010 that you would make contact?
How long did you didn't work with it for very long, did you?
No, it was a cameo. I mean, all of us except for, what's his name?
Roy Schneider.
Yes,
right. How about 2010 Ray Schneider seducing Russian?
No, it was a fun game. I knew it wasn't going to be 2001. We didn't have Stanley Kubrick. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, but except I thought that the very end with the two sons was kind of interesting. But
Do you have any qualms about doing it?
No. As a matter of fact, I thought, who else is going to play that part? I should play it. Yeah. I was in Hollywood doing something else, and I saw the Hollywood Reporter that we're going to make the film, and actually I called MGM and asked to speak to the director. We'd never met, but I convinced the secretary to put me through because I explained who I was.
Yeah.
And I said to him, before you decide on who should play the part, I think we should have lunch together. And he invited me to the commissary, and because I guess he figured I'd be 18 years old. But I was 18 years older. That was 18 years later.
How old were you when you did the picture?
I was 30 when I made the film. So 18 years old, I was 48 when I made 2010. But I looked pretty much the same. And that's why he offered me the film about 12 hours later. I heard from my agent that they called and said, offered me the film.
Okay, another question from upstairs, far away. Say your name first and nice and loud for us.
Hi, my name's Aiden. I'm a media teacher. And my question is whether there was for both of you guys, whether there was a piece of direction that Mr. Kubrick gave to you on set that's really stuck with you over the years.
This will be kind of a disappointing response.
Thank you.
Never. as Kira mentioned earlier, Kubrick, he looked at film on us and decided that, I remember one day he said this to me. I did a scene where my parents say happy birthday and I'm lying there half nude getting suntan. And I don't say much. I thought Kubrick played Hal, and he said something to me, and I responded to him in kind. But Stanley did it, and he said, I had a certain look. It's kind of a chilling look in a way, and you'll see tonight. And I don't do very much. It's all kind of internal. And when it was over, he turned, and he said, let's do another one. And I said, is there anything you want to fix, or would you like some other kind of reaction? He said, no, absolutely perfect. He says, I don't want anything else. He said, can you do it exactly the same? And I know it's not a nice thing to say, but I'm one of those actors who can do it exactly the same, because that's how I look at it. I'm kind of an architect type. And I said, yeah, I can do it exactly the same. So, afterward, he said, all right, cut the print. He looked at me and said, you can, huh? Yeah.
Very good. I thought I'd ask you a question downstairs. Another one downstairs.
G'day, my name's Aaron. I'm in film school at the moment. My question's also about Stanley Kubrick. I'm not sure if you can have an answer for this or not, but what do you think Stanley would think of films today? And on that note, what do you two think of films today?
What do you probably think about that? I don't know how he would, I'm sure Stanley saw all of the important films of their time right up until his death. You know, when you ask that question, I don't know why the first thought that comes to me are all the great films that we will never see that he might have made. That's the most important thing I can think. I can't tell you what film, I really don't know what his favorite films. I never talked to Stanley much about.
Do you stay in touch with Stanley? Do you stay in touch with him? later in life? Did you stay in touch with Stanley after the film was finished?
No, I actually snuck onto the set of The Shining. I know Malcolm McDowell apparently felt kind of slighted because he felt he had such an intimate relationship with Stanley, and then it didn't happen. I never took it personally. Stanley, to paraphrase Shakespeare, you know, he said, the play is the thing, the film was the thing. Stanley was always involved in the next project, and there was no other world for Stanley. Stanley was not a real social entity. He didn't do a lot of socializing. He would have us to his house for dinner every once in a while, but basically, he never went down to downtown London. He stayed way out in Elstree, wherever he was living, way outside of London. And his whole world was the film that he was working on. So he sent me a wonderful wedding gift when I got remarried some years later. And I snuck onto the set in one of those hallways in The Shining. And he came around the corner, and there I was. And he looked a little shocked. He was fine, because it was a closed set. But I would like to have stayed in touch with Stanley, but I never took it personally that we didn't stay in touch.
And to answer the second part of the question, do you guys go see movies?
Give me a response. I can give you a response to that. I was a bit of a charlatan in college, a money lender, a poker player. Okay? And Kubrick had been a chess hustler in the village. And so I had a little different rapport than anybody on the movie. And one day he said, Lockwood, I would really prefer if you didn't gamble with my crew. And I said, why is that? He said, well, some of them owe you money. One of them just left. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, your stand-in just never came back. And we just got him trained for your stand-in, and he was gone. And I asked one of the other guys, "Why? Where is he?" And they said, well, he left. And he said, I understand he owed you money. I said, yeah, I did. He's a really bad gin player. And I don't know if you Australians play gin rummy, but we do. And I said, well, you know, we got hours of waiting for the lighting, and I play cards with some of your crew. He said, no more cards for Benny, my crew. Okay. And then I said, well, why would in those days, the English weren't making over, 20 pounds a week, 25 pounds a week. The guy was making 50 pounds a week as my stand-in. Why would he leave? The cockney guy turned to me and says, well, it was a cock, you know. I said, huh? He said, how much did he owe you? And I said, about 50 pounds. He says, he gave up a 50-pound week of job, and he left? And I said, right. He says, man, he's a cockney. It's not that he lost the money he would have made. He'd done you out of 50. Kubrick one day said, Muhammad Ali is fighting Henry Kuth. I said, yeah. He said, you gonna go? I said, nah. I said, you gotta rent a tuxedo and go. In England, you gotta go to the Victoria Sporting Club in tux. I don't wanna bother with that. He said, do you know the odds on the fight? I said, yeah. I go, not really. What are they? He says, 8-1. I said, 8-1? Yeah. He says, I'm thinking of betting 500 on Henry Cooper. And I said, you are? He said, yes. And I said, I'll book it. He said, well, for those of you who don't know gambling, booking means you want to make a bet. I will take it. Don't go to your bookie. Everybody in England's got a bookie. And he said, you'll book it? I mean, if you lose, that's $4,000. I said, I'm not going to lose. He said, well, Henry Cooper is a heavyweight fighter. It's 8-1. Come on, you don't think so? I said, I'll book it. He never bet.
We've only got 5 minutes left, so we'll just keep going. Upstairs, one more question upstairs and one from downstairs. Mike, where you go?
Hi, Carlin. This is more just a sort of personal question, but what elements from the book, movie, of the story have had the most profound impact on you two, having had such a close relationship with Kubrick and Arthur Clarke?
What? I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure.
Any particular parts of the film or...?
No, just, general elements presented in the story. Have any
you know, had a profound impact.
Any resonances in the film that resonate particularly with you? Any moments in the film that...
Oh, well, my favorite part of the film, at least the first, when I first saw it, was the Dawn of Man sequence, because which was filmed at the end. It was the last thing to be filmed.
It was the last
time you shot. Done the film, that's when they did the Dawn of Man sequence. I guess I didn't have...
And of course, you weren't there for the shooting of that, so you had to see it.
No, I was home.
So you had to see it for the first time.
And also, it touched my memory of having read the short story that Stanley Kubrick, that Arthur C. Clarke wrote and was published initially in 1949 in a science fiction magazine, and years later was published in an anthology called The Sentinel, and that's the film, that's the story that Kubrick read and decided it inspired him to make 2001. So it was the Dawn of Man sequence that I flipped over when I first saw it.
Terry, any moment that resonates with you in the film that you always, that you feel something for?
I can't say, you know, that I have favorite moments in the movie. When we call him Moonbreaker, when he has been exposed to the monolith, and he's flipping bones sort of haphazardly looking for little bugs to, you know, to gather to eat, and he's going like this, and he pitches a bone, and the bone has like a, you know, the teeter-tot of a cannonball advantage of this thing, and the bone goes and hits another bone, and then Dan Richter played that, and he goes like that, and then he stops, and he goes like that, and he, you'll see it tonight, those of you who haven't seen the movie, he looks over, and then he kind of goes like that, and then he picks up a bone, and he kind of hits it, and he starts breaking other bones, and then pretty soon, they're at the waterhole, you know, and this is their weapon. I think that's a pretty wonderful moment. I also very much like when Keir DeLay disengages Hal, and the data bank is just clear plastic cells start coming up, and eventually Keir is disconnecting them, and it's incredible. And he's staying, you know, playing for me.
And just quickly, Keir, you do certain bits of the film stay with you, because I believe this is a sequence of film, this is cut from the film, a speech that you made, which you can still quote to this day. Want to give it to us? It's not the film, is it? It was cut from the film.
Yeah, there was a communication with the Mission Control, and I saw it was coming up in several weeks, and I was worried about the dialogue, because it was so technological gobbledygook to me. It was going to be like learning a foreign language. So I studied that speech. There wasn't a lot of words in this film, but I studied that speech over and over and over, and it was never used because he decided it was redundant. It wasn't that sorry. But I could just do it because of the way I memorized it. 1966. I'll go to my grave. I'll do it quickly. Mission Control is the night trade element at 1920 on board 12 Mission Center and an Eagle Zero computer. Alpha Echo 3-5 units, possible failure within 48 hours. Request check your in-ship system simulator. Also confirm your approval. Our plan to go EPA and replace Alpha Echo 3-5 unit prior to failure. Mission Control, this is X-ray Delta 1. Try it. Mission concluded.
Look, I'm sorry. Look, I know we don't need more questions. We really have you on with the film, because otherwise we're going to finish too late. Thank you so much for lining up, but we have to move on. I want you to give a fantastic... Now, these guys, by the way, they're here for the Supernova. You've done Sydney and Adelaide already. Tomorrow is the last time in Australia. They're at the Royal Melbourne Showgrounds tomorrow from 10 a.m. All day Saturday, all day Sunday at Supernova, the Melbourne Showgrounds, along with lots of other stars for science fiction projects and so on.
Somebody come by Star Trek on me tomorrow.
Thank of course, you. Gary was in the second pilot of Star Trek, the second pilot of William Shatner, the original, the second pilot ever made for Star Trek as well, so that's another bona fide of your science fiction wise. Please thank the guys.
Thank you. You've been wonderful. You really